not to let the coronavirus dominate every aspect of our lives. This morning, I pick up my sermon series on the seven principles of Unitarian Universalism. One of the recurrent themes that I've tried to weave in throughout this series is that of relationship. While the first principle, it's true, focuses on the individual, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, each subsequent principle is based in and seeks to remind us of our relationship with others. The fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process, makes this explicit. We believe in living relationally. We believe in living in such a way that we can encourage one another to practice all seven principles. Another theme I've been repeatedly weaving in is this idea that these seven principles, our current denominational covenant, did not just drop out of the sky. They evolved organically out of earlier spiritual source material, including but not limited to the Bible and classical philosophy. Compared to the ancient Greeks and Israelites, ideas about democracy are quite modern. The United States is the longest continually functioning representative democracy in the world, 246 years. But our democratic roots go back at least another 150 years to the early 17th century. That was when religious dissenters made their way by the tens of thousands across the Atlantic to the rocky, unyielding soil of New England. Why? For some, economic opportunity. Then as now, many immigrants to our shores came in hopes of prosperity. For others, there was another equally compelling motivation, the establishment of a new, more perfect order of society. The 150 years immediately before 1776 can be read as a training ground for establishing that society. In Massachusetts, our oldest Unitarian churches were established with just this idea in mind, how to organize their community in such a way that people were free and responsible and good to one another. The story of how our 17th and 18th century forebears pulled this off, or tried to, is a great one, with low points, the Salem witch trials, and many pinnacles. One of the ironies of colonial life was how, once the colonists escaped religious persecution in Europe, most of them quickly imposed persecution on other groups here, most notably the Mennonites, Catholics, and Quakers. Among the original colonies, only Rhode Island and Pennsylvania practiced religious toleration. All the rest had one established church that was supported, along with its ministers, by civil taxes. And there was much harassment and pressure to conform, as chillingly depicted in the writings of Nathaniel Hawthorne. One of the unsung founding fathers was the Virginian George Mason. He took a back seat compared to the more flamboyant Washington, Jefferson, and so many others, but Mason was a patriot equally important to the establishment of our democratic institutions. He had distaste for committee work and contempt for those whom he called babblers, who, then as now, predominate in politics. George Mason mostly avoided public life, except for two important occasions. From 1775 to 80, he served in the Virginia House of Delegates, where he took a leading role in every aspect of formulating a new state government, and almost single-handedly wrote the state constitution and Declaration of Rights. The second occasion was in 1787 when Mason was persuaded to serve as one of Virginia's seven delegates to the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. He was one of the convention's five most frequent speakers, arguing passionately for individual freedoms and against centralized governmental authority. He exerted great influence, but during the last 2 weeks of the convention, he decided not to sign it, which is why most of us never heard much of him. He explained, however, why, and he explained at length. His foremost objection, no Bill of Rights. But there were other problems too. The slave trade had not been outlawed. The House was not representative enough, and the Senate and federal judiciary were too powerful. These fears led Mason to conclude that the new government was destined to become either a monarchy or fall into the hands of a corrupt and oppressive oligarchy. The strongest bulwark against such tyranny was the right of conscience, he argued most persuasively. It was through George Mason that the very idea of freedom of conscience enters the public sphere, becoming an aspect of what we today understand political and social freedom to entail. When it comes to our evolving democratic consciousness, George Mason played a key role in the 18th century, but there were others, like Anne Hutchison in the 17th century, Frederick Douglass in the 19th century, Martin Luther King in the 20th and their like, as well as the ones we're all familiar with, including James Madison, who ultimately pushed through a Bill of Rights during the first Congress of 1789 to 90. Taken together and across the centuries, these and many others are all responsible for the evolution of democratic consciousness. But it's up to us to keep that evolution going, keep it evolving. As the historians Charles and Mary Beard wrote, the American Revolution started before the first pilgrim landed on Plymouth Rock and continues to this day. Because democracy, properly understood, is always evolving, always in process, always up for grabs. In the end, the Constitution's elaborate system of checks and balances was not enough for George Mason because it did not have a Bill of Rights. Why would that matter, you ask? Because democracy involves far more than elections. It's majority rule, of course, but far more important to democracy are minority rights. And it's minority rights that the first 10 amendments to the Constitution protect. Mason and the other Philadelphia delegates were all familiar with the many crimes that have been carried out by colonial authorities against religious minorities. Other minorities too, but it was religious minorities in that era who seemed to draw the authorities' greatest ire. I suppose our American hearts and consciences were not yet ready to grapple with fair treatment for ethnic and racial minorities, let alone the challenges of gender equity and speciesism. But the important point isn't what minority is being oppressed, it's that democracy rejects all minority oppression, whatever its focus. And it does this no matter how large the majority or what policies they support, by insisting on certain inalienable individual rights. Our fifth principle support for the democratic process and that inalienable right of conscience. This applies to both our congregations and society at large. Let us for a second consider what democracy means within the 400 member East Shore Unitarian Church. It means, first of all, that we affirm the right of conscience within this church. No one is ever to be coerced into believing or agreeing to anything that doesn't feel right and make sense to him or her or they. That makes consensus harder, surely, since we are not all on the same page at the beginning all the time, or even often. But if faithfully abiding by the democratic process within our congregation is hard, how much harder to pull it off in society at large? And yet that is our goal, our ideal. Today, it seems to me, the most oppressed group in our country at large is not the Mennonites or the atheists, but the poor. In a country where running for office requires millions upon millions of dollars, one person, one vote has become instead $1. one vote. Those who can pay have access to political power. Those who cannot have virtually none. George Mason's warning about being taken over by a corrupt, oppressive, aristocratic oligarchy begins to sound eerily prophetic, especially in light of the 2010 Citizens United Supreme Court decision legalizing, for the first time, unlimited anonymous campaign contributions. This is why, in my opinion, the voice of prophets like Francis Moore LaPay must now more than ever be heard. Democracy requires an informed electorate, but how can we have an informed electorate when 90% of everything we see, hear, or read comes through the editorial offices of six multinational media conglomerates? Conglomerates apparently committed to a stance of abject dismay when asked the question of why anyone would want to attack the United States or Paris, France. Because Muslims hate democracy? I don't think so. Maybe instead it's because the West advertises democracy but rarely practices it. Or in America's case, maybe it's because we are only 6% of the world's population consuming almost a quarter of its resources and enforcing our right to access those resources no matter what the cost to native populations or their ancient traditions. The coronavirus pandemic has sliced across all aspects of our lives. Now more than ever, our democracy is up for grabs. There's a lot to be done between now and November 3rd, and lovers of democracy must not allow coronavirus or anything else to distract us. There is a way to turn this thing around and jumpstart the living democracy Francis Moore LaPay cries out for, and it's a way that no legislature or tribunal or Politburo is likely to think of, the way of individual conscience. This is why it's imperative that we practice exercising our consciences here in this safe and sacred community with one another every day. Let our church here be a training ground for democracy, real living democracy, that we may go forth and carry out from here a legacy of loving relational consciousness where every conscience is honored and living democracy prevails. So may it be. Amen.